If you're looking for the perfect gift, you're covered with a gift that's sure to wow. Taste of Chicago ships Lou Malnati's legendary deep dish pizzas nationwide. Plus, they ship other Windy City favorites too. Visit tastesofchicago.com to order today.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Paul Lisnick Behind the Curtain, my opportunity to step away from the world of politics and law you watch me cover on television every day into the world of entertainment, which we do here on the podcast. But today is a real treat because we're going to talk about one of the greatest, interestingly enough, not actors in entertainment of all time, but one of the greatest creators and producers. It's a name you will know, a new book about his life. It's all about Norman Lear. And joining us is the author of a brand new book just came out called Norman Lear, His Life and Times by Tripp Wetzel. And Tripp joins us. Tripp, congratulations on this great book.
Thank you very much. And thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So I have to tell you that that while I'm a huge Norman Lear fan, one of the things that you will relate to is that when he wrote his autobiography a few years back, I had the opportunity to sit with him for about a half an hour in his suite and interview him for my show. And that was an amazing treat. So it was fun to see the sort of, not necessarily the differences, but the sort of juxtaposition of your writing about Norman and some of the things he said to me, which I'll share with you as we chat.
I can't wait to hear it. No, I agree. It was a lot of fun doing the book. I read his biography myself. He signed it for me when I was in my last book on the Improv Comedy Club. Mm-hmm. And I had the opportunity. I had the opportunity to meet him several times over the past 10 years or so. I interviewed him for TV Guide for a retrospective on the 40th anniversary of All in the Family in 2011, and I also. He zoomed in. I teach a class on him as well at Emerson College in Boston, where he went to school and I went to school, and I'm on the affiliated faculty. And he zoomed in on my class twice.
Yeah.
Lovely guy. I mean, he was a wonderful guy. He was not able to participate in this book, unfortunately, but he was just a really good guy. So anyway, yes.
And you detail that. I think it's the beginning part of the book where you sort of talk about the fact that you had talked to him that I think, was it during COVID maybe that he zoomed in? Yeah. And then you also said when it came to the book, you did want to get a sit down. You couldn't. But yet it's not as though he didn't want you to write the book because the wishes from his people that came to you were, we wish you well.
Well, take that as what you will. I mean, they did wish me well. And, you know, one can take it either way. It was ultimately a no. So but it was, you know, it was a polite no. And, you know, whatever you can say. I mean, I wish I'd been able to talk to him. I mean, I mean, there was a good wish you well, but. You know, yeah. I guess you can infer that either way or any way that you want. But yeah.
Well, I took it in a good way when I read it. So
It was fine.
Yeah.
It was
good. And I kind of regret that I never, when I interviewed him, saying, "Hey, Norman, can I have that hat that you wear all the time?"
He had several hats.
Yeah. Well, I see. You could have given me one. I just didn't ask.
Yeah.
So here's the thing, you know, we said Norman Lear, and yet there's an assumption, and having said that, you know, that everybody knows exactly who we're talking about and what he's done. And the reason they sort of should is because he's probably, you write this in the book, he's one of the few creators or producers of shows who actually became as well known as the show he produced. I mean, ask somebody who created Pick a Show. Most people couldn't tell you, except when it comes to Norman's show of All in the Family and Sanford and Son and Maude. And I mean, you can go on and on with what this guy created, and you capture it all the way through. One of the things that struck me, we'll talk a little bit, just for those who aren't as familiar with him, he was a military guy. You give us some of his history, but just briefly sort of tell us, how does this guy go from, you know, the beginnings that he had, and he ends up, he's writing for Martin and Lewis and all this kind of stuff. The war comes in there before all that happens.
Right. Well, it was really a fluke. He never had any really aspirations to be a comedy writer per se. He wrote a humor column in high school and at the Weaver High School. But he was sort of wanted to be an actor maybe, but his real aspiration was to be a press agent. He attended Emerson College in Boston on a scholarship that he won from the American Legion, and 4-year scholarship. And then he decided to drop out of World War. He decided to drop out voluntarily to enlist in World War II because he just felt so compelled to do it. But his real aspiration was to become a press agent. And his father, because he had an uncle, Jack, who was the only uncle in the family. His father went away to prison when he was very young for selling fake securities. And so that had a real serious impact on Norman's life. But he had an Uncle Jack who could always flick him a quarter every time he saw him, every time he entered the room, give him a quarter. And he was always, he always wanted to be the one who could flick his niece or nephew a quarter. So he aspired to be a press agent, not really knowing what a press agent did, but he, you know, I thought this is the road to prosperity. He worked for, as a Broadway press agent here in New York for a while, writing what they call bon mots for gossip columnists. Very successful. It's a big Broadway publicity firm that handled Frank Sinatra, who would be the star of his first movie, Come Blow Your Horn. But he got fired for a column that he wrote that was made up that appeared in a very influential column for Dorothy Kilgallen, who was a very famous gossip column. And, you know, these were the days, the very famous.
That name we can tie her to the Kennedy assassination, right? But we won't get into that conspiracy.
No, Dorothy Kilgallen was a very famous, you know, these were the, this was the era of the gossip columns.
Right.
And in Chicago, you had Irv Kupcinet, the legend Irv Kupcinet. You had, who appeared on WGN, I believe, for many years. You had, in New York, you had, you know, Wenzel. You had all these people. So he did that, and he, you know, he was, he got fired for this. He moved to L.A. originally to restart his career as a press agent for the film studios. And while he was doing that, he partnered with a guy by the name of Ed Simmons, who went on to write and produce the Carol Burnett Show. And Ed was a good friend of, Ed was the cousin of his wife. And one night Ed had moved out to LA to be a comedy writer. And one night his wives were at the movie, and Norman helped Ed punch up a bit that he'd done on the film The Sheik of Araby, and it was a film parody, and he did that, and they decided to form a comedy writing team, and they wrote a bit for Danny Thomas, who was the most popular nightclub comedian in the country at the time, and it went over so well that it got them hired on the Ford Star Review. Jack Haley Ford Star Review. Norman's cousin, as a matter of fact, was David Susskind. They were very famous talk show hosts who, at the time, was a package.
Also of, Chicago. We had him play here.
Yes. And it was from MCA. It was a package for MCA, was putting together the show for Ford Star Review. And, so he did that. And so that's how he got to be a comedy writer, because he got to be on all these shows. David Susskind saw Norman. He didn't know he was in L.A. writing comedy for some reason. I never understood why. Mm-hmm. He never explained that. But he saw this bit, great bit at Ciro's that he did, which is a very famous nightclub out there for Danny Thomas. Got him on to which ended up being the catalyst for him getting on all these to become a comedy writer for all these variety shows in the 1950s. So one thing happened after the next.
Yeah, and I mentioned Martin and Lewis because
Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford. And then he, after that, was started doing films and formed his own production company with Bud Yorkin, who had been a stage manager in the Colgate Comedy Hour.
And that's a name, of course, that we now tie to Norman Lear as Bud Yorkin with all these shows.
Yes.
For folks who are watching us or listening to us, obviously it's the TV show starting with All in the Family that triggers them. So the bottom line is they should read the book, because all these early stories you're talking about that took him where he ended up are there. And I think it's really interesting to learn about that part of his life. But here's one thing I didn't know, and I don't remember this either from Norman's book or my conversation with him. I'm going to word it in an interesting way to let you pick up on it. But one could argue that the reason we have All in the Family is because Bert Lahr, the Cowardly Lion from The Wizard of Oz, died. Now, that, of course, seems like it has no connection, but you explain it.
I absolutely think that is just dead right on target. No one's ever brought that up, but it is completely the case, because Bert Lahr, who played the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz, had a bit part in this film.
The Night They Raided Minstrels.
About Night They Raided Minstrels, which was filmed in New York, and it was about a Amish girl who moves to New York to become a dancer and accidentally invents the striptease at this burlesque house, the seedy burlesque house in New York. Elliot Gould was in the movie. Jason Robards was in the movie.
Carl Reiner.
Carl Reiner was in. No, Carl wasn't. Was, oh, Carl was in. He was in the movie. I didn't realize he was in the movie.
And I could be wrong, but I think he was.
I don't think he was. I don't think
okay,
he
was. Okay, we'll go with
yeah.
you. You're the expert.
No, he's actually he's not. I would have known that. He's not. He was not in the movie, but he was a lot. It had a real all-star cast, and it was pretty favorably reviewed. I mean, actually, it was one of Roger Ebert's very first reviews, and he loved it. The late great Chicago film critic Roger, you know, one of his very first reviews in the Sun Times gave it a really
By the way, my
up.
Mistake. Carl Reiner tied to The Russians Are Coming. The Russians Are Coming. That
yes, 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 yes.
All right, my bad. Go ahead.
But anyway, that's okay. So Burt Ward died during the making of this film, and it wreaked havoc in the editing suite. And at this time, Norman read about this British show called To Death Us Do Part, which was making waves in England, and he also. Bud York had told him about it. Bud York was in England making a film. And all these things happened. And Norman, you know, wanted to do this show because it really reminded him of his own relationship with his father, the dynamics of that. So he set out to buy the American rights to it and get it on the air. It took about 3 years for ABC. Did two pilots for ABC, which both were turned down ultimately. And in 1970, CBS was looking to... You know, kind of rebuild, not rebuild its image, but looking to, you know, get younger viewers and looking to shed its images. The purveyor of all these rural sitcoms like The Beverly Hillbillies and Green Acres. And as a result, you know, he was in the right place at the right time. A young programmer named Fred Silverman, who was the head of programming at CBS and actually worked at WGN in Chicago, started his career at WGN in Chicago.
That's right. A lot of great stuff. Bill Friedkin started at Chicago.
Yes.
At WGN.
Yes.
But anyway,
yes.
Go ahead.
So that's what makes being on this, it's such an honor to be on WGN. And so much learning as you guys have too.
Yeah.
But anyway, Fred Silverman was the new head of programming. He was the head of daytime program, but he had recently been bumped up to head of programming. He loved the show. Robert Wood loved the show. Robert Wood was the president of CBS. So they wanted to get the show on the air. And that's kind of how it happened. That is how it happened. Although CBS had reluctance. Bill Paley, the founder of CBS, didn't think that it was, thought it was a very vulgar show at first. And wanted them to turn it down. They didn't want to do the first episode, Meet the Bunkers, which if you watch it, is just like, it's just like shocking to see that, especially to think that could have gone on the air over 50 years ago now, which is astounding.
I remember I was a kid at the time. I mean, it was the early teens, and I remember the show coming on. My memory was that it was a summer replacement series on Tuesday nights at, I think, 8 o'clock. But I remember sitting in front of the TV waiting for that show to start. Maybe it wasn't summer replacement, but I thought it was. And it was blown away by it. But here's the thing. What some people don't know, because we know the classic Carol O'Connor, Gene Stapleton, we know the cast. But you walk us in the book through the fact that these weren't necessarily the original players that he wanted. Mike and Gloria were to be younger players.
Yes.
Younger characters in the book. So just talk for a moment about how Carol O'Connor gets it, because a lot of people ended up thinking Carol O'Connor is very much Archie Bunker, and he was anything but.
No, well, Norman had seen him in What Have You Done with the War, Daddy, another film. Carol had been around for years as a character actor on television and Broadway. So had Gene. Gene had been in Call Me Mister and Damn Yankees. So he kind of knew about all these people early on. But that's sort of how they were cast. But they were sort of, you're right. I mean, Carol O'Connor was the antithesis of Archie Bunker. I mean, he was a liberal, very left-wing liberal. And that's how he got the role. But Mike and Gloria were not originally Rob Reiner and Sally Struthers. You're right. Yeah.
And the show tackled such issues. It was so, it's why it was a landmark. When you think back, you know, today, if you talk about things like, you know, being gay or rape or just all the things that happened over the course of that series, you'd go, okay, what's shocking about that? But back in the early 70s, this stuff had never been dealt with. And Norman did talk to me about this. So, and you have it all in the book. He had many a fight with censors, with producers, certain lines that they wanted out. Even Carol O'Connor would say something, and those guys really got strong enough in their roles to basically say, you take that out, and I walk.
Yes. Well, he did that from the very beginning. You know, and not only was it controversial for the issues that they dealt with, but for the politically incorrect way that they dealt with them, too.
Yeah.
I mean, because of the language, you know, that you would hear in the racial epithets and stuff, and the slurs that the stereotyping. So you had those two things, and the way that they dealt with now is a much more politically correct way. I mean, unquestionably, when we think about any of these same issues in today. But Norman, you're right. He stood his ground. He knew that if he buckled the first time, he would be buckling battle after battle after battle. So he stood his ground. And the first episode, which was Meet the Bunkers, which had been the pilot for ABC, he was not going to do a third. He was not going to do a third pilot for CBS. That was a different show. I mean, it was now with Archie, with Carol O'Connor and Gene Stapleton and Rob Reiner and Sally Struthers. So it was the same script, but he wasn't going to do a different show. It's the exact show that they did two other times. They just reshot it.
But in that show, wasn't the Michael character was called Richard?
Yes, he was, and yes, he was originally he was Richard, and they didn't want to do. And he didn't want to do, again, CBS didn't want to air that first show because they thought it was so controversial. The one concession Norman did make was in the original, Mike is seen, or Richard is seen, zipping up his fly when he comes down on downstairs. The premise of the show was that it's, Mike and Gloria are throwing a party for their anniversary, and that's what they're doing. So, and all this. All the everything comes out there, and Norman's argument was, you have to get all wet at once. You can't get wetter than wet, meaning that everything had to be threadbare, and it was as threadbare as it could be.
When they dealt with issues, I remember early on in the series where, Mike and Gloria had a gay friend and whatever, and Archie had to deal with that. Then, of course, we have a situation where Archie had a gay friend and didn't even know it. And yet, you watch those episodes today, and while they seem a bit dated because of the issues, they're still, in many ways, just as shocking to watch today, right? In terms of, because his reaction seems so real. Although, as you say, Carol O'Connor himself was liberal.
Well, I mean, the issues, of course, are still there,
Yeah,
but
well, yeah.
what seems dated is obviously some of the political references are dated. The way that they dealt with it was certainly dated because you don't deal, you know, you one doesn't deal with those things the way that they did 50
Right.
years ago. So that is what seems dated, but it's still very, the issues are still very much there.
And by always making Archie look like a buffoon, like when he wrote a letter to President Richard E. Nixon,
Yes.
there was always, it was almost as though Lear had his way of just going, remember, this guy is a buffoon.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the malaprops were just part of the character. I mean, they were just, and the physicality of everything and the way he,
Yeah.
that was just part of it.
And bringing in the African American neighbors, and we'll talk about that because it leads to an offshoot. But the other one thing I want to talk about, I wish we had hours to do this, so I move things along. But I can still remember when when Gene Stapleton decided to leave the show,
Yeah.
and essentially Norman decides we're going to kill off Edith. That's going to be how this has to happen. But what was amazing was just not only the reaction, but there were some interviews, and I've seen them, of Gene Stapleton, that she herself, in some respects, because she was an actor, she didn't get it. She would, and you have her quoted in different interviews, which she says,
No, she didn't get
Edith
it.
is not real.
She didn't get it, and she was like, "Get a grip, people!" She was a character. She was a character. But of course, it was a you have to understand Norman's vantage point, and it was a delicate vantage point because I mean, she was one of the most beloved television characters of all time, and so he didn't want to do it in any classless way. I mean, he didn't want her to die in a violent way, like let's not have her killed in a car accident. Let's not have her run off on Archie or for or, have them get a divorce. That wouldn't work. Although he did have an affair during the seventh season. Three-parter. He didn't want to do any of that. So this seemed to be like the, let's have her die and have a stroke in her sleep and die off camera. So that's what they did.
And she was not in that episode.
It was not in the episode. It was the season two opener of Archie Bunker's Place, which she had not. I mean, see, after season eight wrapped, when Mike and Gloria left for California, when Rob Reiner and Sally Struthers moved to California, because Rob at that point was starting to do films, Sally wanted to do films. And Norman at that point was really ready. They'd been on 8 years, and they were sort of feeling like it's time to get off the air. Get out while the getting is good. I think I don't know if this is a surmise or not, but I mean, Mary Tyler Moore Show did that the previous season. They were actually on one premiered on CBS one season in 70. And I think that may have had something to do with, I don't know. I never asked Norman that, but that's just a surmise. But yeah.
But I mean, yeah, you see the power of television, as I said, when somebody can create a character and it impacts people that much that even the actor just doesn't get why it was. Of course, what she needed to realize is she was amazingly impactful in that role. I met Jean once. She was appearing here in a show with an all-star cast, and I went to the cast party, and so she's a very tall woman, very tall.
Well, she was an incredible actress. She
yeah,
was
a absolutely. Actress. So many shows come. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. One other episode that I have to talk
sure.
about. There's so many you could. There's the pregnancy episode in the elevator, which Carol O'Connor had issues with, and
yep.
it turned out to be great. But the two-part rape episode, to actually have Edith Bunker get raped,
yes.
how they dealt with that, and I'll never forget. I think it's the way the episode, the part one ends with Edith running out of the kitchen and the audience goes nuts. It's clear that the reaction was cut off, probably for time's sake. But
yeah.
once again, something people just were stunned by.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was an amazing episode. And that episode was originally intended for Anne Romano on One Day at a Time. Norman read that, that this was going to be doing, you know, there was another guy the younger woman, older woman being raped. So she said, let's do this for Edith. And the guy that played the rapist was I forgot his name, but he passed away a couple of years ago. He had the same name as that very racist guy who with the KKK ties from Louisiana, who ran for Senate in Louisiana about 10 years ago.
David
Dukes.
David Dukes.
Thank you.
Right.
Ah, my God.
Yeah, probably not a name you want to have as an actor, but I guess
no,
that's
no, not at all.
But that's your
yeah,
name.
We compliment each other well. That's great. Thank you.
Yeah. Talk about, so there were so many offshoots of this, and I'm sort of curious, and you write up, you cover all these as well. This is the life of Norman Lear. So it's not all just about All in the Family, though I have to say that's the part I devoured because I just so love that show. But you get the African-American Neighbors, and boom, we get the offshoot, you know, and there's
right.
the Jeffersons. And of course, we'll talk about Maude with Bea Arthur. But was it your sense that you know, sometimes you have a show which is meant to be a pilot for another show.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get the sense of that here. I got the sense that Lear introduces these characters, they gain in popularity, and he just recognizes that they can be an offshoot. So the Jeffersons, he doesn't just go next door to have an episode with them. They move on up, right? They become
yes.
wealthy, and he moves them on up, and then so he can play with different dynamics that you wouldn't particularly expect in that kind of setting as well, always playing with it.
That's right. The different dynamics were there. Well, of course, I mean, you know, Lionel Jefferson, who's played by Mike Evans, was brought in as a guy who was John Rich, the director, actually wanted Cleavon Little to play him because Mike Evans was a totally inexperienced actor who had walked into CBS Television City, open casting call, never acted in his life. He was studying theater at City College in Los Angeles, but he had no experience whatsoever. But John Rich saw his natural talent as this guy that kind of could go with Archie, and that's what he did. He was brought in, and then his parents were added a few episodes later. Lionel moves into the neighborhood, although Sherman Hemsley was in Pearly on Broadway, so Norman, you know, waited to bring him on, and Mel Stewart played the uncle. Isabel Sanford,
right.
You know, Louise from the beginning. But that was, and that they were on the air for about two or three seasons. But the first spinoff, the first direct spinoff was Maude. And that had originally been intended to be a one shot episode for Bea Arthur. Archie, well into the second season, he wanted someone who could just come in and slay Archie and just give him as good as, you know, give back to him as he dished out. And he
Enter Cousin Maude.
Cousin Maude. And the premise of the episode was that the Bunkers are sick. They all have the flu. Edith is running herself ragged. And Cousin Maude comes to take care of the Bunkers, who Archie detests, and vice versa. And played by Bea Arthur. Bea Arthur was a good friend of Norman's, who they'd worked together. She appeared on a episode of the George Gobel show. He'd seen her in a couple of things on Broadway. He was the only person he could think of. She didn't really want to do it at the time, but she it was you know originally you know it was a, meant to be just a one shot thing. And before the episode went off the air, before that episode ended, Fred Silverman saw it and said, "You know, we're going to put this woman on her own show," and that's how that happened. The Good Times was an offshoot of Maude, and because Esther Rolle played their
Maid,
family's
Florida.
first maid, there from Florida, and was the sassy maid. And then there was so much great stuff there that they decided to eventually spin her off into her own show. And what happened, John Amos was playing her widowed, her husband, who was a fireman. They lived in Harlem. And then about a week later, they said their goodbyes because Henry got a big promotion, and they have a tearful goodbye. Maude and Florida have a tearful goodbye, and say, "Oh, we're never going to stay in touch, yada yada yada." And then a week later, they're in Chicago in Cabrini Green with Good Times, and so that was that show, and that was intended to be a well, it was the first two parent African American family on television dealing with some very gritty issues at first, but it got usurped by Jimmy Walker and Dynamite, the character there.
Right.
But then the Jeffersons was an offshoot of, Norman already had All in the Family. And I think, was maybe thinking about doing something to do that eventually, to spin that off. But what happened there was when Good Times became very successful, and Mike Evans actually co-created Good Times with Eric Monte, who was a young African American writer, came from Chicago, originally grew up in Cabrini Green, and had a lot of talent, but kind of really got in his own way. We could do a whole podcast about him, so
Right.
I won't diverge. But he was trying to do that, and the Black Panthers came and stormed Norman's office one day and said, "There are black people doing just as well as white people, so let's." So Norman said, "Okay, that's kind of how the Jeffersons was born." So that's kind of how those are.
And he takes it all. Well, before we leave Maude, of course, probably I'm going to guess maybe the most famous episode pairing in Maude was when she got pregnant. Now, even at her age, whatever, but the issue of whether she would have an abortion. The notion of, again, in the early mid 70s, for this middle-aged woman to have to address whether or not she would have an abortion. Today, we might see that on any TV show in any, but back then, you never saw that.
Well, that's actually not true.
Okay.
Contrary to popular belief, Maude was not the first show, TV's first abortion. There was actually two others. There was in 1963 or 1964, E.G. Marshall and Robert Reed on The Defenders. There was an episode on The Defenders about them defending a doctor who was performing illegal abortions. And then there was a Another World, which was a well-known NBC soap opera. There was a storyline about that too in the 60s, like mid-60s. But as in terms of a sitcom, Maude was the first show to
And
do it.
that's what I meant. You're absolutely right. It had been addressed with, but put it in a sitcom format. That's not why people turned into sitcoms,
That's
to see
correct.
those
That's
kinds of
correct.
issues addressed.
That's
But
correct.
nobody could pull it
And it
off.
was just and it was just before Roe v. Wade was passed when it originally
Right.
aired. There was a thing called, it wasn't Planned Parenthood, but it was an organization, a birth control organization, population U.S. for population control. It was a non-profit, I forgot the name of it, but they were doing a contest for, TV, with offering a big prize for TV shows to come up with the most creative storylines about about population control. And Norman had already done a miscarriage with Gloria and All in the Family. He didn't want her to lose another baby, I don't think. And I think he wanted to leave the door open for her to eventually have a baby, which she eventually did. So I think that's why he decided on Maude, and that's how that I think that's how it evolved. The Rocky Kalish and Irma Kalish, who are a very famous comedy writing team who'd written for every show you can imagine, from they also wrote for some of these shows like My Three Sons and
No.
Family Affair. Just every They were veteran sitcom writers, and they were the ones that actually came up with that idea. And but Susan Harris, who went on to read The Golden Girls and Soap, was the one who actually wrote the script, and she had written a few All in the Family episodes at that time anyway.
So let me tie the. I'm glad you mentioned Golden Girls. I'm gonna have this lead to a story you don't know, and that shocked Norman when I told him. And I've never talked about this sort of in this public way, but. of course, when you take Rue McClanahan and introduce her, she was on Maude, and she and Bea Arthur had a long working relationship.
Yes.
And obviously Golden Girls primarily, but people forget that she was also on Maude. How would you, to the extent you studied and looked at this, how would you describe the relationship between Bea and Rue?
I think they got along well. I mean, they were pretty close friends. Betty and Bea did not get along, but I think Betty and Rube got along pretty well. That's from everything I understand. I don't know any friction between them, at least not on that set. I mean, generally speaking, the Maude set was a very happy set. I spoke to several of the writers. Of course, a lot of the people that were no longer around. But, I mean, I did interview Samantha Macy, who was Bill Macy's widow, Adrian Barbeau, Mary Kay Place, who went on to play Loretta Haggers on Mary Hartman. Mary Hartman, who started as a PA on that show. I started in several writers. It was a very happy set.
So here's the surprising story. I've never said this, but all the players are no longer with us, so I think I can say this. And I told this to Norman, and it really surprised him. So when Bea Arthur passed away, and I had interviewed her several times, and I interviewed Rue McClanahan the next day about something else. And in that interview, I started off the interview by saying, by the way, Rue, I just want to extend my condolences to you. And she said, why? And I said, well, on the loss of Bea. And her answer was, I don't care. We just work together. We're not friends. I don't care. It stunned Norman when I told him. He goes, I can't believe that. And in fact, when I was doing the interview, Entertainment Tonight was next to me. And they went, can we have that footage? And I said, no. And I never aired it either. That just stunned me, and I'm guessing it stuns you to hear that.
It does stun me, because I thought, you know, they worked together on two series, and I never really knew of any friction between them, but I did know about there was, again, the friction I knew that's pretty well known between Betty and Bea.
Betty always took the high road. I had a half-hour show with Betty when I brought that up, and she said, no, I know people say that Bea and I are fine. We don't socialize, but I see her at the market. I see her out. So Betty always took the high road in describing that relationship. Yeah. I had some guests. This is a Golden Girls world, but I had some friends who were guest stars in that show who had some other Bea Arthur stories. Anyway, I love Bea. She was always nice to me. I didn't mean to diverge from that, but I just thought you'd find that.
I do find it very interesting. No, I never knew that. I never knew that.
So, and then when we talk about African-American families, let's remember Sanford and Son, because that was a sort of a different flavor of show that he did, but it wasn't, you know, taking the family and moving them up and down. That was a different flavor for him, for Lear.
Well, it was a different flavor, but you know, that's sort of, that show was done by Tandem, and he and Bud were responsible for getting into the United States, and it was off of a British show called Steptoe and Son. Mm-hmm. It was originally intended to be first Jewish and then Italian father and son. Then they finally decided to make it African American. They cast Red Fox, of course, as brilliantly as Fred Sanford. But
brilliant casting, yeah.
Yes, but Norman didn't really have that much to do with that show. I mean, other than in name only. I mean, you see in the credits, you know, Bud York and Norman Lear, Tandem production. But Bud was really for the first few seasons, a showrunner on that show, as with Aaron Rubin. And then later, Bernie Orenstein and Saul Turtletap.
So, and of course, but Norman does get a lot. I mean, people think of him in that. Let's go broader out here in the few minutes we have left, which is, why is it, do you think, that Norman Lear, unlike most producers, I mean, if you go to people and talk about I Love Lucy, maybe they'll know the name Jess Oppenheimer. I certainly know that. I'm friendly with Greg, and I'm a big fan of that show and all that. But I think the typical person might not. What is it about Norman Lear that led him to stand out above and beyond all the things he created?
Well, because, I mean, you know, he was such a humanitarian. He was, you know, and he used his power He went beyond the television camera to use his power. He believed in what he did. He walked his talk, certainly, you know, with the People for the American Way and all the other social causes he promoted. He was a very passionate man. And, of course, you know, I mean, I Love Lucy was, you know, in terms of the sitcom standard, they are the gold standard for the sitcom in terms of what they did. But Norman Lear was the first to do that kind of a show. He was the man that changed the game in terms of, you know, what else was that? You know, he created the template for all others that followed, arguably. I mean, of course, I Love Lucy did too. In terms, it was the first three-camera sitcom. It was the first sitcom for the live studio audience. And, you know, it's a classic show and has never been off the air. But, You know, Norman Lear was the first man to deal with controversial issues and topical issues on television in a way that had been done before. And he gets the credit because he was the first man to the table.
But when he did all these things initially, I mean, today, if Norman Lear were with us and he said, I have a new show and it's going to be the most controversial thing ever, every station would line up and say, we'll take it. Or maybe Netflix, but somebody will line up and take it. At that time, what was it about him that led CBS to say, we're going to take a chance on this guy that's going to deal with issues and even not bad language, but language, the things people just don't do on television. This is the guy to do it. And we, CBS, are going to take a risk on this.
Well, again, CBS at the time was looking to do something different because they had these rural shows on the air. Their demographics were aging. And they're becoming known as the Hillbilly Network and the Country Broadcasting System. So they were looking to do something new. And the show was a funny, 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 funny show. And that's what it was. It was a great show. And they said, you know, it's kind of time to do this. It's time to kick the ball down the road. And they did. They were willing to take that risk. And they were not only willing to take that risk, they were willing to give me a commitment for 13 original episodes and 13 repeats, which would be unheard of today. And many of his later shows, he didn't get that same chance. I mean, even after his huge track record, he had a lot of shows that you know, were canceled. Some of them were just not that good. Were not given a chance to find their way.
When I interviewed him, there were already shows. I mean, the man at that time, he was in his late 90s, and he had ideas. He was not done. He was going to proceed.
No, he was never done. I mean, his energy was just amazing. Yeah. He was like, you know, he was just an amazing guy.
50 years from now, Trip, will we still be having classes and talking about Norman Lear?
I hope so. I don't know if I'll be alive to teach them, but may I live as, I mean, I'm 54, so may I have that life too. Yeah, I mean, I would like to think that we would, but who knows? Hey,
that puts you in Norman's age range, so you're perfectly fine.
Yeah.
That is good. We've got the cover on the front of the thing. I have to be careful because of the green screen here, but the book is Norman Lear, His Life and Times by Trip Welzel. Congratulations. Pretty book. Got pictures in the middle of it that I love looking at. I just devoured this book because I'm such a huge fan. And if people don't know Norman Lear, well, then you ought to check him out.
Thank you.
One of television's greats.
Yes. And Trip Welzel. You can buy my book on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and from my website, which is normanlearbio.com.
Again, all right. We'll put all that on the site. Trip, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's fabulous. Thank you.